Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Would you want to live to be 100? Are you prepared in case it actually happens? Thanks to modern health, sanitation, and nutrition advancements, if you've already celebrated your 65th birthday, you can expect to make it at least to your early 80s, and things will look even brighter for your grandchildren. Fully half of American girls born in the year 2000 can be expected to still be alive in 2100. So how will the first several decades of our lives need to change as growing to be very old becomes the norm rather than the exception? Dr. Laura L. Carstensen is founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity and author of A Long, Bright Future, Happiness, Health, and Financial Security in an Age of Increased Longevity. It's just been released in a paperback edition, and she's in town to speak this evening to the UT Dallas Center for Vital Longevity. Laura, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So part of this surge in longevity has to do with the fact that in the developed world, we've reduced infant mortality. It starts with something, it's not simple, but is as basic as that.
Right. The story about living a long time is actually not so much a story about old people as it is about very young people. Mm-hmm. And the reduction in early deaths as recent as a century ago.
So I did a little survey on my Facebook page the other day, and I asked my friends, would you want to live to be 100? And if so, why not? And most people said, absolutely, but only if I'm in perfect health. Right. You know, what are the chances of that?
Oh, the chances of living to 100 in perfect health are pretty slim, actually. Most people over the age of 65 have at least one chronic disease. But these are diseases like hypertension or arthritis. They aren't necessarily diseases that are limiting people in their day-to-day lives. So there are certainly many centenarians who are living independently on their own, happy, engaged, enjoying life.
And, you know, there are a lot of articles out there about, you know, the declines that begin, you know, as early as age 30, you know, things start to happen.
23, actually.
23. Thank you for that. Well, I'm well past that. And, you know, you don't feel it day to day, and nothing that doesn't change necessarily when you're 70, right?
That's a really important observation because I think younger people often look at older people and think, oh, that's going to be just awful, you know, or even to hear what I just said, there's some chronic disease or that'd be terrible. Mm-hmm. But actually, we, you know, there's nothing more slow or steady as aging. And these changes that come about are relatively mild within each domain. That is, you know, some hearing and vision. And you get little changes in all of these, but they're very gradual. And so people tend not to experience aging subjectively as this horrible, disabling thing that occurs, again, in the absence of serious disease.
And you make the point that we're all in this together. There's no magic pill that makes anybody immune to the effects of the years we spend on the planet.
That's right. We're all aging. And I like to tell people every opportunity I get that anytime somebody's trying to sell you a product that is going to slow or reverse aging, just know that they're not telling you the truth.
You're throwing your money out the window.
You're throwing your money out the window.
Yeah, we have the state fair going on right now, and there's all kinds of junk being peddled over there.
Yes. And, you know, it's so many of these products are called anti-aging products. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, you know, the alternative to aging is not good, actually. So, you know, the issue really is aging well, not aging. And I think once we sort of start to straighten that out, we can see more clearly what our future is going to be and how we might alter it.
So I really like this actuarial fact. If you make it to 65, you're quite likely to make it well into your 80s.
Yeah, well into your 80s. And you know, the average age, life expectancy at 65 is 18. And that's the average. So, you know, you're saying half of people are going to go beyond that at 65. So, yeah, we've got some long lives, long futures ahead of us.
Why are people so distressed by the idea of getting older when if they asked a lot of older people, they seem to be pretty happy with their lives?
Right. It's a real paradox. Again, I think it has something to do with what people are assuming old age is like. I teach a course on longevity at Stanford, and this has become a very popular course among undergraduates because we teach it as this is about you and your future, you know, for better or for worse. And at one point during a class, I had kind of turned to students based on their questions. I was sort of curious why they were all dreading this so much. And I said, wait a minute. Now, if I understand you right, this was based on their question. I said, if you knew you could be smart, rich, and good-looking when you're old, you wouldn't mind getting old? And the whole class went, no, it's fine. then it would be great. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not aging so much people are worried about. It's what they associate with aging, and that is, you know, being scorned and feeble and not good looking, not strong. And those are the kinds of things people are afraid of.
Well, it's funny because we don't hold an 80-year-old to the same standards of attractiveness that we hold a 21-year-old. You know, there's plenty of good looking 80-year-olds out there.
There are. That's true. But, you know, subjectively, I think a lot of people looking at themselves don't feel quite as comfortable because their comparison is what they looked like when they were younger. There's an interesting phenomenon, I think, actually about subjective aging and how we view ourselves, and that is that somehow we don't keep updating ourselves as we get older and older. Mm-hmm. So you hear this very common experience of people in their 60s and 70s saying, you know, I walked by a mirror one day or saw my reflection in a window and I saw this old person looking back. And it's like a shock that somebody's staring at him. It's like, who's that? And so we somehow aren't updating our views of ourselves. And then when we look at the image in the mirror, it's kind of not as good as we thought it was going to look.
And I guess even harder than that is for younger people to really imagine that they will be there someday. And you write about an interesting experiment in the book where I guess you took people's photographs and digitally aged them and then asked them what they would do with a certain amount of money that they were given.
Right. We were trying to address with this study this problem of young people's inability to envision very old ages themselves at old ages. And the problem with that is that if you can't envision yourself, what people tend to do is they come to treat their future selves like they would strangers.
Huh.
So they don't save a lot of money or quit smoking or the heavy drinking or something because they're not worried about that future person.
Hmm.
So we thought if we could help them identify with themselves at a future age, maybe they would treat themselves better, help prepare better. So, yes, we take young people, take their photograph, and create an avatar. And in one condition, the avatar is themselves at the same age.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one, we age morph it, so they're now 60. And they put on this headgear, and the experience that they have is that they're in an apartment walking around, and there's a mirror on one side of the apartment wall. So every time they move or look around, they look and they see themselves, but at an older age. And at the end of this session, we ask them a lot of questions, but embedded in those questionnaires is a question about savings. And we say, imagine you have $1,000. How much of it will you allocate to these different buckets?
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is retirement. And the students who had interacted with their older selves allocated twice as much money into the retirement bucket as those who had interacted, same experiment, but interacted with themselves at the same age.
So that old gal deserves a nice place to live and good food. And
Right. If we can relate to ourselves, then we start to say, yeah, I think I'll treat her like I would myself.
Yeah. And along those lines, one of the things you say that we ought to think about doing is when a new child is born, starting their retirement account at birth. And I think people hear this and think, well, we got college, we got a million other things to pay for. Why is that a good idea?
It does a couple things. One, it actually helps people begin to have a mechanism to save. So a lot of the problem with saving or starting a 401k, if you don't have one or any, it's that initial, you know, going and opening an account somewhere. So the account exists. So if you can do that for a young person, great, start the account. It gives, you know, relatives something to write a check to on birthdays or Christmases or holidays, you know, when they want to contribute. So it does that. But I think even more important, perhaps, is that it creates an image. It creates a symbol of the future that they begin to think about. So now they have this account and they're looking toward a certain age in life, a stage in life, with a little bit more clarity. And they're giving that stage in life a little bit more thought.
So let's talk about the future of this society. The other fascinating fact that I mentioned in the introduction is that girls born in 2000 in this country can expect, half of them can expect to still be around in 2100, see their 100th birthdays.
Mm-hmm.
And by the middle part of the century, there will be more people over 65 in this country than people under 15. That speaks to a really different kind of world than the one all of us have grown up in.
It's a very different world. For, you know, throughout human evolution, there have been many more young people than old people. Back in school, I and I'm sure many listeners learned about population pyramids, mm-hmm. you know, this shape where you have many at the bottom of whatever species winnowed to a teeny peak at the top. Yeah. And those were the survivors, the oldest ones. And what's happening is that that pyramid is being reshaped into a rectangle, mm-hmm. which is just an overwhelming kind of a statistics. And because what it really means is that the vast majority of people being born in the developed world today are going to live out their full lives. Hmm. So now we get to anticipate old age as a normative stage. And this is very important for individuals. But it's important for societies too. As you say, if we have more people over 60 than under 15, which is a point we'll reach by 2030, right around the corner, then what happens to society? I mean, and the real question there becomes, it depends what older people are like, and it depends on what they're doing, what their health is like, what their emotional lives are like. And there is nothing about this demographic that represents destiny. The demographic says it matters now what older people are like. And now we have to make sure that older people are the way that will make societies better and not take a toll on societies.
Another myth that you recount here is the idea that growing to be very old means that you will be a burden on your family and on society.
Yeah. That's certainly the fear, and that's the fear that most people in Washington today have. It's that older people are a drain on society. Again, the culture that we live in today is a culture that's giving older people lots of mixed messages. Mm-hmm. You know, we're saying, on the one hand, get out of the workforce, make way for younger people. You know, you should move away. And on the other hand, we're saying, oh, we don't want to take care of you. You know, yeah. You need to kind of,
you're on your own.
You're on your own. You better work and do other things. So we need you to stay engaged. And so it's not clear to a lot of older people what society is asking of them. But let me paint a picture of what society could look like, and I believe will look like, mm-hmm. When we have a population that's heavily weighted with mature, experienced, emotionally stable, educated individuals who have already taken care of their own personal individual needs and their family's needs. They've raised their kids. They've achieved something in their career. And now they're ready for something really big, and they're ready and have the ability, have the talent, the expertise to give back mm-hmm. to society. Older populations, older societies could and should be the very best thing that ever happened to young people.
It's so interesting when you say it that way, because people hear it, the numbers, and they get very alarmed, and that sounds like utopia.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is interesting to me that doubling life expectancy, nearly doubling it as we did in the last century, is something that only humans could experience and complain about. You know, it's like, what could be better?
Oh, we don't like change, you know.
I guess so. But, you know, premature death is what we've eliminated. Hmm. That's the real shift that's come about. And so people aren't dying early from these diseases that could have been preventable, and now we're preventing them. And so people are living longer.
My guest this hour is Dr. Laura L. Carstensen. Her new book is called A Long, Bright Future: Happiness, Health, and Financial Security in an Age of Increased Longevity. She is founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity, and she's in town to speak this evening at UT Dallas's Center for Vital Longevity. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity, Dr. Laura L. Carstensen. Her new book, just released in paperback, is called A Long, Bright Future. She's in town to speak this evening to the UT Dallas Center for Vital Longevity. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Laura, I distinctly remember in sometime in the 1970s, my grandmother getting her senior citizen's card. She had turned 65, and she was going to qualify for a discount at all these places, and it was sort of a new thing back then. Mm-hmm. First of all, how did we decide 65 was the age at which you sort of matriculate from, you know, older middle age to being a senior citizen?
To being old. Yeah. Right? We've declared that happening at 65. Although I must say that AARP these days is trying to dig down into even younger people there. So they're sending out those membership cards, even younger.
Cradle robbers, right? AARP.
Right, 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 exactly. This really goes back to Bismarck and Social Security, their Social Security system in mm-hmm. Germany. And as people began to think about these programs, for old age programs, they had to have an age where people would become eligible, and it was arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
Although I must say that in the early 1930s, which is where this first happened in Germany and then the U.S., we just stole their number, 65, life expectancy was not nearly as long, and life expectancy at 65 was not so long.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a point in time where governments felt that people had worked long enough and maybe ill and didn't have that much time left, and so the government should provide some support. So it was really because of social policies that we identified this as the age. But now that's become this cultural norm. It's come to have great symbolism. 65 means something to a lot of people beyond entitlement to a program.
Yeah, well, even aside from those programs, when people are making choices about retirement, that's the age they imagine they will leave the workforce. And if they can leave a few years earlier, very often people feel privileged. If they have to stay in a few years later, they feel, you know, beleaguered.
Mm-hmm.
Your sense is that it may not be the best thing in the world to jump out of the workforce at 60 or 65.
Right. Absolutely not. If you're healthy and have some skills, it doesn't. I don't see there's a real strong argument for getting out of the workplace. You know, today, just as you say, 65 is the number that people think of as the magical retirement number. But the average age of retirement in the United States is 62.
Mm-hmm.
So people are trying to get out early. If you can get out early, it is you're a winner.
Right.
You know, if you even get out of the workforce sooner. And, you know, it's an interesting culture of age and of retirement where we tell people they should stop doing something they can do. It wasn't that way before we had these policies that helped support people. It wasn't that way a long time ago. And, you know, early 20th century people worked until they couldn't
dropped.
Work anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Literally. I mean, generally, you know, back in the days where there was the family farm, the parents would eventually do a little bit less and a little bit less, then kind of move inside, not out tending the field mm-hmm. so much. And then, you know, eventually, but always contributing.
Right.
And eventually you get so sick, you go to bed and you die, you know. But retirement wasn't a stage in life. You know, it mm-hmm. wasn't an era where people, you know, sort of thought you were now entitled to something related to leisure.
What's ironic is that it seems as if, you know, it makes perfect sense that if your job is very physically demanding, that, your back gives out, your knees give out, you just can't do the same things you mm-hmm. did. Those tend to be lower paid workers. Those are the people who often can't afford to leave the workforce, whereas knowledge workers, people who do what you and I do, they're the ones with the resources to take off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think as we move into this era of longevity, we will eventually come around to a very different culture. And my hunch is that we'll begin to dissociate chronological age with these kinds of programs mm-hmm. and modes and decisions, so that individuals who need to stop a particular job or who do need some sort of a support will get it, but not necessarily people who don't need it. 65, again, it is arbitrary and it doesn't mean anything much. It's not that much different than 64 or 62 or 61 for a lot of people. Again, it's really we're talking about health and, you know, sort of physical capacity. And then, as you say, how that's matched with your job in society. If you've got a lot of arthritis and your back is, you know, out of whack, and what you do is you build buildings and you work with a hammer and a nail, that's really hard at that age. But it's not hard for everybody. And in fact, for a whole lot of people around 60, 65, they are just hitting their stride. I mean,
I think about Hillary Clinton, you know, and she doesn't look ready to retire.
Right, right. You know, look at the government. Well, I'm not sure that's a good role model.
But and people may not think Hillary Clinton's a good example.
But if you look at or the Supreme Court, I mean, we live in a gerontocracy is mm-hmm. my point. We really, most of the people who are governing this society are over 65.
So what are the advantages of staying in the workforce?
Psychologically speaking, I am a psychologist. Mm-hmm. People feel best when they are needed. Basic human, you know, sort of a value and a tendency. You know, when you the morning you wake up and you get to say to yourself, you know, there's not a soul on this planet that needs me. I don't have to do anything today. It's actually not a good day.
Yeah.
You know?
So, yeah.
You know, but feeling like you're part of something and that you really have something to offer is a very good feeling. So for most people, work offers that. Now, family commitments offer that too. You know, we derive a lot of meaning from helping people we love and care about. But we also do to contributing more broadly to society. So I think it's good for people emotionally to continue to work. It also turns out that it looks like it's real good for cognitive functioning.
Hmm.
You know, we've got a whole lot of people playing these games, video games and computer games that are ostensibly going to help keep their brain sharp.
Yeah, you can buy them for $99 a package that's going to stave off the effects of aging and dementia.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if only they did. But it looks like if you continue to work, you get that kind of stimulation. And mm-hmm. here's the real good news. You get a paycheck, too. So, you know,
which is important because it's, you know, I think about starting to work at 21. If I were to retire at 65, to work for 44 years and then, you know, retire for another 30, I don't think I could make the numbers work.
Well, and a whole lot of Americans are not making the numbers work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a major problem for us. You know, we a lot of things happened at the same time. We started to live longer than we ever expected in the last century. But we also companies shifted from pensions to individual retirement accounts.
Right.
So all of a sudden, individuals are supposed to be the ones saving and preparing for their futures, not the company. And we're living much longer than we anticipated. And so that's a mismatch for most Americans financially. Most people really need to work more than 40 years to be able to have a comfortable retirement for another possible 30 or more years.
Mm-hmm.
So working will help an awful lot of folks.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Dr. Laura Carstensen, author of A Long, Bright Future. First on the line, we have Tim in Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hi there. Great program as always. I in listening to this, I work in healthcare, and I happen to personally believe that we still live very much so in a society that does not like the aged. If you watch advertising and spend any time at all with the media, that I think that becomes very, very clear. And you touched on that earlier, particularly with the hawking of all of the anti-aging devices and medicines and so forth. Given the statistic of more 65-year-olds versus 15-year-olds, and then the political changes that are inevitable, I agree. I think there's no doubt that we're going to have to work longer. Not a choice anymore, but we're going to have to work longer. So that arbitrary number, I think, will probably just disappear, and it'll become more about necessity than meeting the number, if you will. But you know, on for an anecdotal, you know, kind of take on it, it's amazing how I see time and time again, and this is not only on a personal level, just at work, what tends to happen to people when they decide that it is now time to, quote-unquote, quit. That idea of quitting seems to become all-encompassing with some people, and it's amazing how quickly their physical health deteriorates the minute that they decide that they're not going to, quote-unquote, do anything anymore. Any ideas or comments about that?
Yeah, so it depends on what people mean by quitting. It is true that people who work are in better physical health than people who don't work. older people I'm talking about now. But it's hard to tease that apart
from cause and effect.
Right. So there are an awful lot of people who leave the workforce who feel like quitting because it is so hard on them, and it's because they have a physical problem. So it's hard to pull those two things apart cleanly. But I think the quitting is really the word that you use that's such a good word, because if you retire and quit, it's a very different thing than retire and, say, move on to your encore career or become more engaged in volunteer work or in the community. There are a lot of things people can do, paid or non-paid, but being engaged is certainly important for individuals.
I know that you've heard in this economy, as we have reported on this show, there are lots of people who would like to continue working. And as they get into their, even as early as their late 50s, if they happen to lose or leave a job, they find it really hard to get another one. What do we do about that?
Yeah, this is a major problem. And of course, at this point in history, the economy is so bad and unemployment is so high that it's a particularly difficult problem. But there are an awful lot of people who are out of work. The difference with older people is when they lose their job, it's less likely that they'll be able to get back in.
Mm-hmm.
So here at this time in history, again, where they hear people like me talking on the radio saying people need to work longer, there are a whole bunch of people out there saying, I'd like to, but I can't get a job.
Yeah.
You know, so – and that is a major problem. I believe that that problem will be, you know, in a historical sense, relatively short-lived, that it's related to this recession and we'll come out of it eventually. But we need to make these opportunities available for people to stay engaged.
What sort of influence do you think the baby boomers will have on our sort of understanding of what aging is? They have all this influence and relatively speaking, a lot of money. Will they change what we think about old age?
No doubt they will change. I should say we will change.
As a
boomer.
And are already mm-hmm. changing.
Right. Mm-hmm. We will change. We've changed every age that we've gone through. You know, this bubble, this of population that we have here, just because this is a very large cohort that we're talking about. So I'm optimistic, and I'm optimistic for a bit of a cynical reason, but that is that boomers have been and again, I'm speaking as one, so mm-hmm. I get to say these things. Kind of a self-entitled group, a group of people who don't like to be told what to do, who don't probably won't feel comfortable going quietly into the night and just going off and saying, okay, we don't need this or that. And I think at this point in history, again, I think that's a good thing. We need that. We need to be cohorts of people who say, no, we're not going anywhere. And by the way, we're going to continue working. And we're the ones employing more people than anybody else. And we're going to create jobs. And we're going to on and on and on. You know, mm-hmm. We will demand restaurants where you can actually hear what people are saying across from you at a table. We will demand clothing lines that aside from Eileen Fisher, who's great, but we need more for older women, you know, clothes that fit. We need lots of things like that. And I think the fact that we are these generations, cohorts of people coming through who are saying we need things and we want them and we're going to go get them, that's going to help. It's going to help ageism. We're going to not stand for it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when there are more people over 60 than under 15, I actually think that people over 60 are going to do a lot more controlling of the world. And we'll have television shows about us and movies and on.
Not just Cocoon, but
right.
a full range of experiences. Yeah,
that's right.
Another thing that you boomers have done, and I think maybe to an even greater extent with their, you know, Gen X and millennial children, is sort of extend the amount of time we think of ourselves as young people, as the kids of mom and dad, as students. Talk about the effect of that on our approach to working, not only when we're older, but throughout our lives.
That's a very interesting observation. And I recently read a study on this, that boomers don't identify with age as much as previous generations did.
Hmm.
So we don't say, I don't say, you know, I'm in my 50s. So, and that rarely is part of the beginning of a sentence or a thought.
Right.
You know, rather it's, I'm a psychologist. I study aging. I do this. I do that. Mm-hmm. I like, you know, X or Y. And it's much more – we seem to relate to people across generations more by what we're interested in our own individual ideas and beliefs, maybe values, than by age cohort.
Mm-hmm.
And that's new. So we are already, as boomers, sort of forgetting about this age thing. And it's because we don't feel old.
And it's really healthy, I guess, the older you get or the younger you are, to have friends who are of different ages as opposed to only hanging out with, you know, the kids you went to high school with or something.
Yes. And again, you are on to what I think is one of the greatest opportunities long life affords us, and that is that longer lives mean that we can reduce or even eliminate age segregation.
Mm-hmm.
We live in an incredibly age-segregated society, and it really dates back to living short lives. When our life expectancy was 47, as it was in 1900, it made sense to put the children in school. You graduate, you get some kind of education, work preparation, you work, you have a family, you retire, you die. You know, there mm-hmm. wasn't a lot of time. Average life expectancy around 50. And so we parsed life into age-specific tasks. Mm-hmm. So the young are in school, the middle-aged work, the old have leisure. When you double that length of time, we now can and should and really must spread out those things. So we should be getting an education throughout our lives. We should be working much longer, many more years, let me say. But we can change the quality of work life. We don't have to work 5 days a week. Not written in stone. Let's go to 4-day work weeks in many different occupations, but work many years longer, you know, mm-hmm. and so on. So we can improve that. And if we work a little bit less, it means that the middle-aged people don't have to be AWOL from the communities and from missing their families, you know.
I mean, they're raising kids.
As they're raising kids. You mm-hmm. reach the peak of your career, you raise kids, you take care of older relatives all at the same time. So we're missing a lot of what's really important to us in life because we're not because we don't want to do these things, but because we don't have time. We've got time, and now we need to find a way to redesign life that spreads out these different parts of life across. And if you do that, then you've got older people in colleges with younger people because they're going back after a job to retrain and something else. You've got older people in schools and in parks and volunteering, as well as younger people.
My guest is Dr. Laura L. Carstensen, founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. Her new book is called A Long, Bright Future. It's just been released in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Laura L. Carstensen. She's founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity and author of A Long, Bright Future, Happiness, Health, and Financial Security in an Age of Increased Longevity. She's in town to speak this evening to the UT Dallas Center for Vital Longevity. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Phyllis in Dallas. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on the doctor's comment earlier in as far as working and how that helps us cognitively. I'm 46 years old, and my son at 17, 8 years ago, obtained a brain injury, and I immediately stopped working a job that I did a little bit of computer work as an insurance agent, but I was just starting to learn the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And now that my son has moved on and he's living somewhere else, I find myself looking for work, but I also find myself in conversations, I have trouble finding the words I'm trying to say, and just there are all sorts of little things I'm finding that I lack in that I, you know, the skills I used to have, communication-wise, socially, and everything. And I think that the lack of working and interacting with people socially has hurt me over the 8 years, even at 46 years old.
What do you think, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's become very clear is that brains need stimulating environments. But brains are also quite plastic, as we would call it. There's a lot of plasticity, it would be the proper way to say it, in the human brain. And once you get back into a stimulating environment, that'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
So the caller is saying, work does this for a lot of people. There was a study published by some economists just a couple years ago where they compared countries and the functioning of people 60 to 64 to young people 50 to 54 or something like that, as a function of their generosity of the retirement policy. So in France, you can retire earlier than in the United States, and you can get more generous benefits. And so more people do retire in France. So they compared France to Sweden, to the United States and Singapore and these different countries. It turns out that the countries that have the least generous policies, which mean more people are working, those folks have better cognitive performance. So that's probably the best, for me, the best, most compelling evidence that work is doing something good for people. Because in this case, it's not this selection bias, as we were talking about before, where the people who can't think clearly drop out of work.
Right.
It's a whole country, a whole population, and we're still seeing these differences. Work is good.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Bob on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Bob.
Hi. I'd like to, challenge the doctor a bit, if I might. I've always had the impression that, aside from a select few people, that most people, by and large, work because they have to, and they don't like to work, by and large, they'd like to get out of it as soon as they can. Not to say that they can't be active in something else, but as far as just doing what they have to do to make a living, most men truly do lead lives of quiet desperation. And I think I'm hearing something else from the good doctor, and I'd like to hear her maybe tell me where she comes up with this broad generalization.
Right. Good question. I'm forgetting the exact statistic, but it's somewhere in the mid-70s, something like 75% or more of Americans say that they like their jobs to the extent that even if they didn't make money at the job, if money wasn't an issue, they'd continue to do it to some degree. So most people like their work. Older people, by the way, like work, have higher numbers of work satisfaction than younger workers. Hmm. And the people who are least satisfied with work are parents of young children. And again, I think the story there isn't
pulled in nine directions.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. They've just got too much to do, and so work becomes a conflict. To me, what this says is that we need to improve the quality of work. So that's a high number. It looks like most people actually do enjoy their work. But we can make work a lot better than it is today.
Here's a question from Susan in Dallas that relates to something you write about in the book. Susan writes, I am 2 months away from my 50th birthday and realize I would like to change careers. I found tremendous personal satisfaction in spending time with a friend who is now 86 years old. I deeply appreciate the wisdom of our elderly population and feel tremendous empathy. Because I have the luxury of returning to school, what careers do you feel will be in high demand as our population ages?
Oh, interesting question. First of all, let me say that I think in your 50s, it's a great time to change careers. And in part because some people are feeling like, you know, they may enjoy their work to some degree, but they want something new. They need something different.
Right.
You know, they're getting really good at something, but, you know, what's the challenge? So switching to something else is a really good idea. I think it's a good idea to ask yourself what you care most about and to make this next career a career in midlife. I believe, and should be a career that matters to you, where you're taking the expertise that you've developed, perhaps for the purpose, your own individual purpose of earning money, and now applying that expertise to something that will give you great emotional satisfaction. So if you've been in running a high-tech company, what you might do is just to retire from that job and set up a nonprofit getting computers to young children. I mean, you could do something like that. So you move in a direction where you're using what you've learned into something now that matters a lot to you. These are called encore careers. Mm-hmm. That's the new word for this. My friend Mark Friedman, who runs Civic Ventures, is running around the world telling people that this should be the new mode of work, and it just makes an awful lot of sense. And I think it gives people something to look forward to. You know, if we see our work trajectory, not you hit the peak of your career and then you just hopefully stay there at best, and probably at some point start to decline. Instead, you launch yourself
from the plateau. You launch yourself
into something better than ever.
The librarian at my son's school, who is bar none everybody's favorite person there, had a similar experience. She had a sort of corporate career for a long time and then just decided she wanted to do something totally different.
Yep. Yeah. I think it's a great thing. And it's, again, it's cognitively stimulating to switch and do something different. It means you're learning new things, and that's good for brains.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Doug in Fort Worth. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I just had a quick question. At our company, there's been this circulation of this study. I think it was a Boeing company. Some guy did a study of retirees, and he tracked age from 50 on, retiring at 50 on till I think 70 or something like that. And the gist of the article was that basically it was an inverse relationship. The earlier you retired, the longer you lived. The later you retired, the shorter you lived. And I wonder if that's like one of these internet hoaxes that somebody wrote it and sent it out for all the people who are thinking about, you know, early retirement. So I just wonder if the guest was familiar with that having circulated around, or if has any data on the relationship of early retirement versus later retirement and longevity.
It's a good question, and I don't know that study, but I'm sitting here trying to think of possible explanations for a finding like that. I haven't heard that finding before, but I could speculate that people who retire early would be people in the managerial higher status positions within a company. And SES, an education level, socioeconomic status, I should say, an education level, clearly predict longevity. So if it's a difference in who's retiring early by who's got the money and the resources to retire early, my hunch would be that's really what's explaining the effect, not retirement per se.
We have an email here from Kelly who says, "Won't seniors staying in their jobs longer stymie the futures of those entering the workforce? Is there room for everybody?"
Oh, thank you for that question, because this has got to be one of the most misunderstood concepts about aging and work. There are an awful lot of people, again, suggesting that older people need to get out because we need to make way for younger people. All the economists in this country who are looking at this question agree. The more people in the workforce, the bigger the pie. If people delayed retirement by 5 years, David Wise, a Harvard professor, estimates that we would see about a 5-7% increase in GDP. When individuals are looking at older people within a workplace, they can kind of know that, you know, sure, to some degree, it's got to be true in some instances. You know, if only old Joe would retire from the store, you know, then Sam would have an opportunity to go in there and take Joe's. Sure, at an individual level. But at a macro level, at the level of society, when people work, they have more money. That means they consume more. When there are more consumers, there are more positions. So we grow the workforce. People made the same observation about women entering the workforce in the 1970s. They said, oh, but women are going to go take men's jobs away from them. And that was the problem. It didn't happen. We grew the workforce. There was more money, more consumption. GDP went up. We need all hands on deck at this point in human history. We've had a lot of needs in societies, and we need everybody to contribute.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who writes, "The burden issue is one that weighs on me. I do plan to take care of my mother when the time comes. She's 82. She took care of her own parents in old age. But I don't want to be a burden on my daughter. Is there a percentage of families that do take care of their parents as opposed to being estranged or I guess, leaving that care to others?"
You know, there's a stereotype about Americans that we don't care about our older relatives, that in other countries they may do this, but not here. And it is not the case. Most American families that have some vulnerable member of them find the family circling around that person and helping out. Again, part of the problem now with adult children and their is their ability to help their parents. So, again, picture who's the typical caregiver, adult child caregiver, an older person is actually somebody usually these days in their 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not that, you know, we're not talking about people in their 40s and 30s doing this. These are older people taking care of even older people. Mm-hmm. And what most adult children say is that they want to. Sometimes it's hard. They live in another part of the country. They don't have enough time. They're being pulled in multiple directions. But it's generally not for lack of want. People do, you know, want. They care about their members of their family, and they want to be there for them.
1-800-933-5372. Before we take some more calls or one more call, I want to talk about another myth. And one of my friends on the Facebook survey that I did said, I worry about being lonely. And you have not found that concern typically bears out for older people.
Right. Older people have less loneliness as a group than middle-aged people or younger people. Hmm. If we look at different age groups and the frequency of being really lonely, the top of the list there are college students. College student-aged people, young people, are much more likely to be lonely. And, you know, you start to think about writers who have written about loneliness and you know, they often say it's easier to be lonely in a group surrounded by other people than when you're alone.
So no one understands me, but I have all these people everywhere.
Right. Mm-hmm. And older people are more likely to live alone. So they're more likely to spend more time alone. But that's a very different thing than being lonely. Hmm. Older people don't report any more loneliness. In fact, as I say, less loneliness than other age cohorts. They're also less depressed, less anxious, less likely to have substance abuse problems or phobias or, you know, basically any of the psychiatric disorders that we measure, you see in lower levels in older people.
Let's go back to the phones one last time, and we will speak this time with Eddie in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Hi, I'm calling with what may seem like a kind of a challenge, but I noticed your picture of baby boomers getting older. It was pretty rosy and optimistic. It had a lot to do with clothes that fit and a paycheck for you and feeling better about yourself and society. And I was wondering, with the new advent of the older crowd, that wouldn't it make more sense to have sort of a sense of responsibility to the younger? It seemed to me that it was kind of the obverse of the baby boomer teenage experience to have a baby boomer aging experience where it's still all about whether we're going or staying or sticking around or protesting. I was just wondering what you have to say about that.
Hmm. I'm with you on that one. Boy, I think the boomers, you know, lasting legacy should be reforming the culture and our policies and so on that make life fair for people of all generations, and to use our power in numbers to improve the lives not just of ourselves but of our children and our grandchildren, and look toward the future. Working longer is going to go a long way toward doing that. So that's one of the big changes. But absolutely, I am optimistic because I think we like to think of ourselves maybe as spoiled and narcissistic, but also as rebels. So let's change the way we live.
Put that spirit to good use. Dr. Laura L. Carstensen is founding director of the Stanford Center for Longevity and author of A Long Bright Future, Happiness, Health, and Financial Security in an Age of Increased Longevity. She will speak this evening at the UT Dallas Center for Vital Longevity. Laura, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.